This is Unique Smiles, the Facial Paralysis Podcast, and I'm your host, Brian April.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Unique Smiles Podcast. There's a cool new book out called Fix My Face, available on Amazon. We're going to be talking about from the Center for Facial Recovery. We have Jinsy Stezer, and we also have Jody Barth. And, of course, also joining us is Dr. Mike Riley. So welcome, guys. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So I guess we'll start with what is the Center for Facial Recovery and how did that get started? Whoever would like to answer that.
So I guess I'll back it up a little bit because Mike Riley and Jinsy and I have worked together for a really long time, in which we actually started at MedStar Health together. And then Jinsy and I had such a passion for this, for treating facial palsy patients, that we broke off from MedStar so we could open our own clinic. And so, and Michael's been a very integral part of the success of our clinic. So all we see at our clinic now are facial palsy and patients who suffer from DMD or jaw pain type of problems.
So Jinsy, tell us how you kind of got involved in all of this.
Well, I started working for MedStar. Jody and I started working together, and we realized that there were patients coming to us for facial palsy, and there was nothing available for us to know what to do to help them. So we started researching the best practices, and just through word of mouth, more and more people came to us for help.
Definitely. And that's one of the things I found, especially when I first had it, there were very few resources, or if there were, it was a lot of contradicting advice and things of that nature. So what are, I guess, Dr. Riley, how did you kind of get roped in as well with these,
these two? Well, it was a fortune.
And literally we roped him in.
Yeah, exactly.
once you meet Jody, you know you're not getting out of the roping. It's all for the best, you know. So I have a pretty good sense for people. And when I came back to DC after doing my fellowship in facial plastic surgery at UCLA, Jody reached out to me and we had a meeting at a coffee shop. I remember very shortly after I arrived back into town. And she was just so passionate about facial palsy. And frankly, it was just teaching me so much in that first 45 minute meeting that we had at the Starbucks, that I realized, okay, this is definitely something I need to learn more about. And this is a wealth of resource right here between Jinsy and Jody. I mean, they really, it's like earlier you were saying, you know, which one's Jinsy, which one's Jody? It doesn't matter. They're just Jinsy and Jody. They go together. They're a force of nature. So I met them about 12 years ago, and they were kind of, you know, bouncing ideas off me and then, like I said, educating me. And I got so interested in it that I think they saw my interest peak. And then we've just been growing and learning together for the last 12 years. We continue to learn, and they definitely push me to, you know, not accept the status quo, which is, I think, one of the big issues in facial palsy, is that there is a really established status quo, which is just wait and see. And I could tell these ladies were not just waiting around for anything. They were not going to be waiting and seeing what happened to their patients. So,
and so you've all kind of come together and you've created the Center for Facial Recovery, which people can look for on YouTube. If they search Center for Facial Recovery, they can also go to your website, which is facialrecovery.com. And the foundation for facialrecovery.org. So you can check that out. I just want to give that a quick plug out there. So what are some of the things that, Jinsy and Jody, what really kind of gets you motivated? Was facial paralysis something that affected you personally, or, you know, through people that you know?
So that's a great question. No. So I've been a therapist now for 40 years. And I guess it was about 17 years ago, I really had my first facial palsy patient who is status post acoustic neuroma. And one of the doctors sent him to me that was sending me, you know, a lot of referrals. And he said, at the time I was specializing in the jaw treatment of the jaw. And he goes, you do something with the face. Can you figure out to do something with him? And I was like, I don't know. Because, you know, in school, way back when, they taught us the only thing to do for facial palsy is to use that handheld electrical stimulator. And that was it. And so, you know, you realize very quickly how much you don't know mm-hmm. when you start working with somebody. And so it made us, or me at first, do a lot of research. I actually reached out to a therapist in Pittsburgh, Todd Henkelman, and we went up there and spent some time for him teaching us. And he came down and did a continuing education course with us. And just watching this patient, my first patient, just improve and get his smile back. He was a CEO actually for the hospital. And, and so, you know, he was going to a lot of high powered meetings, and he was, you know, very self-conscious of the way he was presenting, and, the ability to give him his smile back, just was remarkable. And, as I said, I've been a therapist for a very, very long time, but working with facial palsy patients is my joy. And that's not BS. It really is. It's because with facial palsy patients, they will do anything to get better. So when they come for therapy, they're saying, what can we do? It's a partnership. It's not me, them coming in and saying, make me better. It's right. Like, tell me what to do. And I will do it. And as a therapist, and I'm sure Michael feels the same way as a clinician, when you have a patient that is all in, it just makes you excited to make them better. It just does. And if your bag of tricks is not making them better, you look for a different bag.
Absolutely. And Jinsy, same question to you. Did you have any facial paralysis in your life, or?
Nothing in my family. I think, infectious when you start working with a patient. You give them their smile back. There's nothing better. I mean, it's just a wonderful feeling. And you get people who they've not done anything for 20 years. They've experienced facial palsy for 20 years, and they come in and it's like thinking there's nothing that can be done. And we work with them and we give them back some of their facial return, and it's joy. It's pure joy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And as somebody who's recently had selective neurolysis, I can totally attest to that. Just the feeling that is, and the emotional impact that facial paralysis or facial palsy has on a person is so big that a lot of people don't realize that. And I personally think it's more impactful emotionally and mentally than it is physically. Now, some people, you know, will have some real issues as far as physically, but emotionally, we all pretty much get hit pretty hard. So I guess I kind of want to open up this discussion a little bit. And since you guys have seen so many patients with facial paralysis, and this podcast kind of goes for people who may have had it for a while, but a lot of people who are just either diagnosed or had it come into their life, kind of listen in to these shows. What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you have seen or heard from a recovery standpoint? And Dr. Riley, I guess we'll start with you. Some of the things that you've seen as far as doing, you know, rehab, and, you know, you mentioned eSTIM previously, and that's a big debate in the world, whether eSTIM or no eSTIM. And, you know, so I guess if you can talk a little bit about some of the important factors early on.
Sure. Well, definitely from a physiologic perspective, the early time period is the critical time period in facial paralysis. You know, just to review what we know about facial paralysis when it happens suddenly, it's inflammation of the seventh cranial nerve as it exits the brainstem. It really is, it happens high up inside the cranium. Right there in this first turn that it makes about a centimeter and a half after it leaves the brainstem, it's a tight area and it has a ganglion there, which is like the garage for nerves that houses a lot of the infrastructure. And the viruses that we know cause most of these really sit there right in that garage, and they stay dormant. If you've had chicken pox or even oral ulcers or canker sores outside the mouth from a herpes simplex infection, once that infection resolves, the nerves kind of serve as a housing chamber for those viruses, and they just stay there latently in your body until they get reactivated. So once they're reactivated, they start to trickle down the nerve and they basically get let out of their den and unleashed on the nerve. But that inflammation stays fairly localized to that area called the geniculate ganglion, which is where we think most of these issues come from people who have acute palsy from a not from surgery or something like that. And so I think that that's a long-winded entree to my answer to that, which is, I think that understanding of really what's happening with this condition is really critical and to the foundational piece of how we then optimally treat people, because instead it's become this kind of formula, by the way, not based on any real good data, how this formula came up, just that this was the formula and this is the one that's been studied, which is 10 days of steroids and a week of antivirals. And then the studies have actually not shown that much benefit of the antivirals. So people kind of are like, you don't even need to do antivirals sometimes. And then wait and see. And that wait and see thing, I think, is the biggest detriment to the people who are in the group of 29%, based on the largest study of over 1,000 patients in Sweden. There was a study that showed that 29% of people who have facial palsy don't get complete recovery. So that's really a disservice to that 29%. And that's where Jody and Jincy and I and the rest of the people in the Foundation for Facial Recovery have really, you know, focused our attention on, is we know we're not going to get that down to zero. I mean, one day that would be amazing. But if we could at least try to get that 29% down to a manageable number, or make a dent in it, reduce it by 5%, by just optimizing the medical regimen that people get on and the therapy regimen that they get on right afterward. Because some of these changes that are long lasting, and you, as you know, having suffered from zoster herpeta or Ramsay-Hunt without the vesicles, you know this. I mean, this damage that you're dealing with now, really probably a lot of it happened in the first few weeks after the onset of your condition. If we can really optimize that care during those initial weeks, I just have to believe we can make a big difference in patients. And we've seen it anecdotally in our own practices, and we do have studies that are ongoing. But it's also an orphan disease. And so it's really hard to get large studies, multi-centered studies, because we just don't have the resources really, or a national leader yet to arrive on the scene from a research perspective.
So I guess I'll throw this out as well to you guys. When you're getting, when someone has, when someone first suffers from their attack, a lot of people again say we'll do anything. We'll do anything we can. And so we're looking for things. What are some of the things that they can do to start to work towards rehabilitating their face?
So positively, if people reach out to us and I don't feel they've been placed on the right medical regimen, Dr. Riley does do telemedicine. So I connect them through telemedicine for him to evaluate, because getting the right medical regimen and getting a physician who really understands this disease and who sees it more than once a year. I mean, you know, we see, you know, 40 to 50 facial palsy patients a week. And so, you know, when you see that many patients, you really start learning from each patient versus the, you know, physicians that are out there who actually, and this you want to talk about what really bugs me is when our patients are at the physician's office and they are Googling facial palsy. to try to diagnose the patient. And it's like, come on, if you don't know, pass this on to somebody who does know. So right. I would say for listeners that are out there, if your doctor is Googling, you need to find a different doctor. you need to find somebody who really understands the nuances, understands the importance of early intervention. So as far as from a patient standpoint, like once we get you the proper medical regimen, the other big area that we find that is crucial is getting eye closure, or at least assisting with eye closure. Because based on our clinical research, we find the longer it takes the eye to close, the higher the risk of developing synkinesis and a more significant synkinesis, the longer it takes the eye to close. So our therapy initially is all about retraining the eye closure. We teach patients taping to give support to the lower eyelid, because the lower eyelid, even though it only does 10% of the eye closure, that 10% is crucial for your tight eye closure and your blink. And we start with fitting patients with external eyelid weights to help them get it closed. And that's where we start on day one, and teaching eye protection techniques and all of that, because, and Dr. Riley could to speak to this more, but there's really no medical emergency when it comes to facial palsy per se, except if you have a tear in your cornea, a scratch in your cornea, something happens to your eye, that's an acute medical emergency. So we want to prevent that from happening. Right. So that's,
and Jody, you know, this would be a good time to talk about the reason and the nexus for this book that we generated last year out of the Foundation for Facial Recovery is just this. It's just giving the information in the hands of the patients, because with diseases like facial palsy, even though we have a lifetime risk in the United States of having 1 in 70 people will have facial palsy in their lifetime, the annual incidence is, you know, down somewhere around 10 in 100,000 patients. And that is not really enough. Actually, I may have misspoken there. I think it's 30 per 100,000, isn't it? But it's not enough to really get enough attention, is my point. And when you have a condition like this, and, you know, I don't even blame the doctors who don't do it all the time, because I just happen to be someone who knows a lot about it. But when you're taking care of, you know, thousands of different conditions, you can't necessarily be expected to be expert on things. And this is the great thing about the information age that we're in, is that by getting this information to patients, we're really giving it's like the best way to get it to their doctors, because doctors will listen when their patients tell them something from a place of knowledge. And I mean, most of them do. The good ones that I know definitely will. So if you get that information to the patient who's got this, you know, obvious vested interest in getting the best and most accurate treatment, then they can start to educate the physicians about the fact that that historic treatment of just like a week of antibiotics and a week of steroid, or a week of antivirals and a week of steroids and wait and see, is not really cutting it. You know, that there's much more to it. And so the patients become their own best advocate. And again, you know, this is a nonprofit. Like all we want to do is to help people with facial paralysis. So that's the reason for the book. We're not getting any, you know, like kickbacks or anything. It's got a lot of knowledge in there that's been acquired by Jody and Jincy's years of therapy experience. And then, you know, by my knowledge base as a facial plastic and reconstructive surgeon, we have input from, you know, psychiatrists or psychotherapists. We have input in the book from the patients who suffer from facial palsy, a dental specialist who deals with the TMD that's associated with facial palsy. So it's a wealth of information. And once the patients have that information, then the change can happen. And then that was our whole mission, was we got to get it somewhere we can actually affect change. We're not going to be able to convince doctors to do this.
Right.
We need to convince them. So.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the book, since you mentioned it. It's called Fix My Face, and it is available on Amazon.com. It's also available through the foundation. Jincy, do you want to tell us a little bit about how the book came to be and what it's about? Or,
well, our foundation got together and we were talking about really what was our mission. And our mission was to educate people, because there's so much false information out there. And so we felt the best thing to do was to gather specialists in the field and all come together to put our parts together so that people would have a guideline for what to do once they get facial palsy.
I think that's really important. Again, as someone who's gone through it and just when I got it, there was basically one website I went to and it was supposed to be helpful, but it was the most depressing place. And again, you're just getting all sorts of information and ideas from all the, well, this worked for me and this worked for me. And it may have been real good advice, but it may have been really terrible advice. You just don't know. So having resources like this that you've provided is such a wonderful thing. And you have all this experience in seeing and treating people with facial palsy. And I just think it's a wonderful thing that you're all doing. I'd like to talk a little bit, the thing that I'm really interested in that doesn't get a lot of talk in the facial paralysis world, at least in the circles that I've been running, is the neuromuscular retraining. Because there are some clinics and some physical therapy places that you can go and try to get some work, but most of them have zero clue about facial paralysis as well, and especially the intricacies of neuromuscular training within the face. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, just kind of on a broader level, and then maybe some basic tips for people who are kind of interested.
So the reason why, so neuromuscular reeducation is not unique to facial palsy. As physical therapists, we do it for multiple different diagnoses. What makes neuromuscular reeducation unique for facial palsy is actually the composition of the muscles of the face. So the muscles of the face are a combination of smooth and skeletal muscles, while the muscles like within your body, your biceps, your triceps, those areas are skeletal muscles. Your organs are smooth muscle, but the face has a combination of these type of fibers. So they're not only volitional or, trying to activate it, but they're also just automatic. So when you see something funny, you're just going to laugh. It's not like your brain is thinking, oh, that's funny. Now I need to laugh. So taking that combination to know how to retrain is what the neuromuscular reeducation is. And the key component is to isolate the specific muscle that we're trying to work, all right? For many of your listeners, they have done reading and they know that there are five main branches of the facial nerve. And each main branch has these little fingers that go to very specific muscles. And so when you do your retraining, you are trying to get that very specific muscle with those very specific branches to activate so you don't have the whole face moving when you, say, go into the pucker. Or when you close your eyes, you don't feel your lower part of your face moving. So the neuromuscular retraining is it's a nuance. We said we go for quality, not quantity. And that we would rather have you do a millimeter of the right motion than a whole lot of the wrong motion. Because if you keep doing the wrong motion, you're going to make that pattern. And it's going to keep establishing that abnormal pattern. But if you start teaching the muscle, even from the beginning of, okay, this is what you're supposed to do, and this is all you're supposed to do, that's the best way to slowly re-educate the muscle and retrain it.
Do you find a difference in success when it's someone who comes in pretty quickly from onset versus like for someone like myself, I've had it for 12, 13 years now and had synkinesis. Do you find that there's a difference?
So we see both. And unfortunately, like Dr. Riley was talking about earlier, unfortunately we see patients once they develop synkinesis. And that's usually when patients are then either sent to us by other physicians, or, you know, they themselves are like, so this didn't get better and now it's getting worse. Because that's what happens is you actually go backwards when the synkinesis starts developing. So when it first occurs and you start getting your smile back, it's like, okay, this isn't bad. My smile is coming back. And then the synkinesis settles in and the tightness settles in and your smile is not nearly as good as it was a month ago.
Yeah, right.
So there, it's two different ways we approach it. For say an acute phase, we're doing it very gradual neuromuscular reeducation. We're working on improving blood flow in the area, you know, gentle massages, things like that. When somebody is more in your situation, Brian, what we have to do first before we actually even try to reeducate the muscle is we have to release it. It is stuck in all of this tight tissue. So I explain it to our patients is as if your biceps muscle is in a cast, and then I ask you to straighten it, but you can't straighten it. Everything's so tight in there that even if I asked you to smile and you wanted to smile, that poor muscle is stuck and so thick in there that it can't do it. So for people who've had it for a longer period of time, a big part of what we do at first is manual therapy, is getting in there, releasing the tissue, trying to get it moving. And we always start that route first before we knock on Dr. Riley's door about the Botox. So not to take us off subject, but, you know, the Botox obviously is an important treatment, but we really try to get this tissue more normal and the muscle to activate more normally before we start eliciting utilizing Botox to.
And you guys really have done a great job educating me about fibrosis and that whole association. It's again, when you harkening back to what the issues are that are not done correctly, is when people say, you know, physical therapy, there's no proof. And then you think about it, would you ever do that for your arm if it was stuck in a solid position for 6 weeks or 8 weeks? No, you would never let your arm just sit there and wait for it to recover. And these muscles need to move. That's how they're made. And they need to have that elasticity. They need to have the ebb and the flow of the contraction relaxing. And if you can't do that from a neural input because the nerve is frozen, then you need to do it physically. And you need to have somebody like Jody or Jency or another well-trained facial therapist to go in there and just keep things mobile and elastic and pliable so that then when your nerve does recover, to the extent that it's going to, and that signal is going back to that muscle again, that muscle still has the freedom to move that it will not have if it just sits there and sticks there until you ultimately are able to get movement. So that's a really key part of it too. And why the therapy, people ask me like, was therapy, you know, what do you think about therapy? And I always say, well, A, I've seen tremendous results from it, but I don't like to just be anecdotal. I like to, you know, try to look for science. There are good studies, like we even have one of our earlier studies showing that people's, you know, had significant improvement in their various facial indices after facial therapy. But I think more like, why would you not do this? And when you put it to people that way and say, if this was any other muscle in your body, would you really just let it sit there for 6 weeks or 8 weeks while somebody, you know, told you it was going to maybe come back, maybe not? And so I just don't see any downside to, especially the manual release and the movement things. I mean, it's an imperative part of the plan.
And Brian, what I would say is we've learned a lot by using diagnostic ultrasound, which I think is unique to our practice and how we've learned so much about this area. So that, for example, if somebody like you came in, we would look at it under ultrasound, compare your involved and non-involved side, and you could really see this fibrosis that Michael was referring to, this thickness of tissue. And then I show it to you on the ultrasound, and you're like, that's exactly where I feel it. That's exactly what it feels like. And then you can see how that's stopping the muscle from trying to activate. And then with time, as you free up that tissue and the nerve regenerates, you can see on ultrasound that the muscle starts moving freer and opens up. I mean, just today, and I didn't get to tell Dr. Riley about this, but one of our new patients, actually, a woman who's in her 36th week of pregnancy and has a zostrus in her petty, and came in fully flaccid. And so when I did the ultrasound initially, there was really no motion. And then today she came in and we're looking at her. And not only did we see activity at every single muscle, but the tissue quality already has improved. So instead of it being like flattened down on layer to layer, which you can see on ultrasound, it had the same texture as her non-involved side, which was, it was remarkable. And so those are the things that keep us going, because we see it, you know, and then we're able to show you those changes. And I think, you know, like we started out with this discussion about education, the more we can educate you and the more we can show you that, first of all, that we understand what you're saying, because we hear it day in and day out. So we know exactly what you mean. And then we can show it to you on things such as ultrasound. It's like, okay, now I can understand what's happening and what's not happening. And it gives you another level of education for your rehab, for the whole neuromuscular re-education concept. Because that's not an easy concept, right? You're taking your brain, who hasn't been speaking to your face in a while, and trying to reconnect them. So any device that we can use to allow you to understand and see what's going on is also helpful.
Yeah, definitely. Because some people are visual learners, some people, you know, and so to see that visual representation may make it so it's very simple for someone to go, oh, I totally get it. Jinsy, I guess I should have asked this earlier. Most of the listeners of this podcast will know this, but for those who may be tuning in for the first time or whatever, what is synkinesis, and what are the common types that you may see?
Well, synkinesis is an abnormal aberration of the nerve. There's a lot of different theories about what happens, but basically we feel that the nerve doesn't, when the facial muscle isn't moving, there's a nerve from some other place that tries to help it. So it comes from a different area and it's redirected then. So for example, when when you close your eye, the mouth goes up, or if you pucker, your eye closes. So it's a redirected nerve impulse.
So that's an example of, an example of neuromuscular re-education. It's an example of trying to disconnect these synkinetic connections. You know, we're not going in there and cutting the nerve that's connected from here to there. That's what you had with your selective neurolysis. But this is a way of trying to disconnect those activities.
And so it can be done it can be attempted with someone who's had long-term synkinesis. Just might take longer. Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm trying to ask is for people who are out there who suffer from this, I know it's a lot of work. It can be quite a lot of work, and sometimes you see, again, you mentioned a millimeter, and people are sometimes expecting everything to go back to normal. What are realistic expectations that people should have, knowing, you know, because you don't want to give false hope that everything's going to go back and be normal, and it's going to be in a month, and it's going to be fixed. And so what is some of the training and the results timelines kind of look like?
I think one of them is again, and I could have Michael talk about this again, but the worse the droop is on initial onset, the longer the recovery is going to take.
And
it's really
if you aren't getting recovery by the 1 month mark, you know, it's like you're kind of on a different curve. Just to chime in there for a second. So we do get a sense within the first month of where people are going to be. Are they going to be on that curve where they had paralysis, but then they started getting recovery in the first month? If so, we have a lot of hope and expectation for a speedier recovery and a higher chance of full recovery. And if they don't meet it by that first month, we're getting a little nervous about their trajectory. There's still definitely a chance for complete recovery, but that curve kind of flattens out a little bit the further out you get to that first movement, which is, again, speaks back to our original comments about why we think it's so important to get optimally treated right away. Because it's like you kind of, once you're on that path, it's hard to get off it. We, even on any path that you're on, Jody and Jincy and I can help you get to the high end of that path, but we can't necessarily move you to another path, you know, after the initial phase of the recovery has occurred.
Right. So if you want numbers, what I, a lot of times when patients come in, we do a grading system. And typically when somebody comes in, say in your position, Brian, and we grade you, just off the top of my head, I would be grading you at like a 50%. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which means I think you're at 50% of your recovery after having it all this time. And some of it has to do with how much synkinesis there is and the retraining of the muscles. And so what we would tell somebody in your case, I feel very comfortable to say I could get you to 75%. That I feel like I can risk my reputation on. Now, what happens, which is a wonderful thing, is that we get you to 75%, and then it's like, okay, well, can we get it a little further? And that's where the three of us, I think, push the envelope, because we do. We do. It's not something I'm going to go out there and promise, right, but we do see it. We positively do see it. And those people that I've promised 75%, we've gotten some of them to 80-85% better. One of the things that we never do is we don't give patients false hope. So we're pretty honest, which, you know, I know sometimes is very hard for a patient, but, you know, to kind of have that important conversation in our first meeting, I think the three of us do that to for you to understand the expectations of, okay, these are the roadblocks. This is where we're going to try to get you. You know, we certainly listen, and any clinician, no matter what they're treating, needs to listen to the patient. What's the most important to you? Because I always say to the patient, whatever is the most important to you, that's what we're going to work on. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter how I think you look. It's how do you feel and what is your goal?
And I think that's a really key advice, a piece of information too, because I know for myself personally, you know, everyone says, oh, you know, when I went through the selective neurolysis, my primary thing was, let's get rid of the pain. Let's get rid of the platysmus that was pulling down, because it was, you know, really, it was a really, really bad case of it, and just get it so that I can get a little bit of a smile, so that I can smile slightly and at least physiologically tell my brain that I'm happy. Just for good mental health. Yep. And, you know, as far as the pucker and, you know, the eyebrow, I was like, I've kind of learned to work around that at this point. And it's not as big of a deal as these other things. So having that targeted approach is such a huge thing, I think. And because it's a lot of work. And so it's better to just focus on what's really important versus trying to get everything all at once.
And just to clarify, when Jody talks about percentages, you know, it's not like we eyeball you and tell you a percentage. We do, right, we have a lot of validated questionnaires. So it's not like, oh, we told you you're 50 today and then we told you you're 75 next week.
Right.
No, we did.
Yeah.
It's like you fill out the questionnaire yourself and then you tell us whether you're at 75 or not. So there are patient graded questionnaires and there are provider practitioner graded questionnaires, and we use a combination of both in the assessment of how you're really doing after an intervention or treatment. So it definitely is validated, at least, and not just hocus pocus, just to make that clear.
So that's a good distinction.
Thanks.
absolutely. I guess a couple other questions for you is, there are a lot of people out there who are looking for help with recovery, with physical therapy, and don't necessarily know where to go because maybe they're not in a major city. We obviously have your book that you're putting out. What advice can you give to people, or do you do, televisits, or what sort of advice or information? Where can people go to look, and what are some of the questions they can ask? Physical therapy locations that they know that they've been involved with this and they know what they're talking about. What are some of those?
I'll answer from the physical therapy standpoint, and then I'll let Michael answer from the physician. I mean, we do telehealth, and I will always talk to you on the phone, but it's really I need to see you. So the telehealth part is very important. And then we have a couple of options. We could do telehealth sessions, and we guide you through exercises, and then also make recommendations for adjunct type of therapies, cranial therapy to work on releasing the muscle tissue if there's not a facial palsy therapist in the area. The other thing is, we could always work with you with a therapist. So if you found a therapist that was interested and was able in your area to work with you, we could do a joint session, your therapist, you, and myself, and I could guide them into doing other things that I would do if you were here in the clinic. Use us as a resource. With our network, we try to find therapists that are close to you. I know I'm always calling Michael saying, do you know any physician in this area? So, we're always trying to help patients find the best, but you could certainly use us as a resource. You can email us and then we can get back to you.
And just echo what Jody said. We're like, as a physician, I don't have a license to practice in every state. I actually have 3 medical licenses, and then I have 2 telehealth licenses that have only come since COVID. And then there are some states since COVID that allow some telehealth practices, and we have an algorithm for how we handle that. So there are people I certainly can see who aren't here, but when I can't, I can't, and that's just the nature of medicine. I can't treat someone, but I am always willing to provide an informational guidance session to help people come up with a plan that's going to fit their needs the best. And then typically what I do is either try to pair them with a physician in their area that I know. Actually, just yesterday, it was great. I got to have a call with an old friend I haven't talked to in 10 years, who's in Austin, Texas, and the patient's in Austin, Texas. And, she needed to see a local provider so she could actually get the medication that I was counseling her that I thought would be a good idea. And so we can make those connections. But it's really critical to get treated early on. And I will just tell you that, forthrightly, that the protocol I use is not outlandish. It's not like I'm throwing random medications at people, but most people don't treat this condition as aggressively as I do. So sometimes I'll get some feedback from primary, like I'll say, hey, listen, here's what I would do. Why don't you take this note to the primary care doctors, or get the book and bring it to your primary care doctor and just ask if they'll supply those prescriptions. And people are a little gun shy. They don't want to give 3 weeks of steroids. Right. They want to give like a low dose of steroids for 5 more days. And they don't want to give 3 weeks with 60 milligrams at the top end for the first 7 days. And in my case, I'll even do that longer if somebody's still not starting to show improvement after 3 weeks. They don't want to give antiviral medications for my recommendation is a minimum of 6 weeks until your immune system's had a chance to mitigate the damage that's being done by the reactivated virus. That's just not standard of care. The standard of care is 1 week for a viral flare. So that's what a lot of doctors want to do. And I understand that. I mean, I'm always full disclosure with patients about what's considered an off-label use of medication. Like a prolonged course of antivirals in this case would be an off-label use of the medications. It's not FDA approved for that specific use. But then there are also other medications. Like there are actually good studies on this brand of or version of medication, this class of medication called calcium channel blockers. There are now 11 studies in the head and neck literature about when people have paralysis in the face, in either the facial nerve or the laryngeal nerve that controls the vocal cord movement after surgery, and they get on these this type of medication, they're in the face, they have about a threefold increase in their likelihood of return to complete recovery. And in the laryngeal nerves, they have an eight to 11 fold increase in their likelihood of returning to normal. So, you know, but I will tell you that 99.9% of people who are treating Bell's palsy are not putting people on a calcium channel blocker when they get facial palsy. So you really kind of just, again, it harkens back to just that knowledge is the power. You're, you know, you are your own best advocate. And if you are able to get that information, which is of course available through us, but it's in written form because we just want to distribute it as widely as we can, you know, get the book, get the Fix My Facebook, take it to your doctor, you know, read it, take it to your doctor, see what's going to work for you, and then try to get a treatment plan. And it's got to happen like immediately. You know, if you're waiting 3 weeks to see how it goes, you know, frankly, you're just kind of beyond the window. Like you need to get that in there right away. So,
and again, you can get this information at facialrecovery.com. Fix My Face, the book that we're talking about, is available on amazon.com, also through the foundation. That is the Center for Facial Recovery. And you can search their videos, Center for Facial Recovery on YouTube. And you can also find them at foundationforfacialrecovery.org. Just a couple more questions, I guess. Dr. Riley, let's kind of switch to just another aspect of that, and that is Botox and the impact of Botox on synkinesis. And if you can just give kind of a quick overview, the benefits of Botox or the reason that it is used within synkinesis and trying to recover from facial palsy.
Sure. So Botox is the brand name that's most known for the generic drug onabotulinum toxin A. And what that is a neuromuscular blocker. So when we inject it into your body, it actually binds to the connection between the nerve and the muscle, and it prevents the nerve from releasing its signal to then cause the muscle to fire. And the way that's used, so you're thinking, okay, wait a minute, that actually blocks muscles from working. Isn't that the problem? But in cases of facial paralysis who have resting spasm or synkinesis, which we've been talking about now for a little while, happens when you start to get recovery. Now you get all this activation of muscles that you don't want moving when you're not trying to get them to move. And don't forget, you have the other side of your face, which is now, it's still fully active and giving it the, you know, the 10 out of 10 movement when the affected side of the face is only able to give you a 40% movement. And so we can, it's important for a couple of things. It's important for some of the neuromuscular reeducation, like Jody and Jinsy have mentioned earlier, where, you know, we don't want you getting the feedback that you're giving us a false smile if you're not. And so sometimes I'll relax the smile on the unaffected side so that their smile starts to come down to more closely approximate the smile on the affected side. And it not only makes them look more symmetrical, but it also gives them the drive to, you know, to try a little harder and that education to lift a little stronger. And so I use a combination approach of the affected and unaffected side. I'll often see patients who've seen other providers who've like, oh, I got injected for my facial palsy and I just hated it. And it's like, well, they were complaining of tightness. Let's say it's the left side of the face. They're complaining of tightness on the left side of the face. And so their doctor, who may not treat as much facial palsy, has injected them with Botox into those muscles. But all that does is weaken the affected side of the face. There are muscles you can inject and there are muscles you can't. Like that platysma you mentioned earlier, that doesn't do really anything for us. And if that's causing tension, I will slam 30 units of Botox into that thing all day long because there's just no reason for it to be causing you any unnecessary discomfort. Your zygomaticus major and minor muscles, which are really responsible for the large heavy lift of your smile, I don't want to put Botox in there. I know it's uncomfortable and tense, but that's where the fascial release and the things that the therapist can do kind of more physically and manually to release fibrosis and allow the tissues to feel a little bit less uncomfortable and less tight come into play. So you got to use the Botox in places on the affected side of the face where it's not going to cause a detrimental effect. The last thing we want to do is weaken that. I know it's tense, but the last thing I want to do is weaken those muscles that are allowing you the smile that you do have. And then on the contralateral side, I can be a little bit more liberal. So, you know, your right eyebrow is going way up compared to your left. Your smile is way bigger than your left. You know, your eyes are closing way better than your left. Those are areas that I can Botox for, again, that harmony and for the neuromuscular reeducation. So it takes time to, you know, the first dose is not always the same for everybody. So we kind of have our ladder of how we do this. The very first thing we typically do will be the affected side in the platysma and the unaffected side in the forehead. And that's just like the very bare bones, like areas you can inject without really any downsides. And then we start to get a little more layered in the nuances of exactly where is your synkinesis? Is it a downward pull of the affected side? You know, when you're trying to smile, can we maybe inject some of the lip depressors on the affected side so that they're not pulling down as much and you get a little more uplift, simulating kind of like what a neurectomy do? Yeah, we can try that. But, you know, each of those next steps comes at a conversation with the patient about priorities, you know, symptoms. Are you also having trouble with your formation of your words? Do you have any oral incompetence when you try to drink out of a cup? Or do you have any spillage? You know, we don't want to do anything to make those things worse. So we really try to keep that entire picture in mind before I just go pumping Botox in. And it is not a one size fits all, but I have yet to find a patient where I don't feel like it did any good. And I'd say, you know, 95% of patients who get Botox really feel the benefits. And then there's a small percentage that say, you know, I don't really know, maybe it wasn't worth it. And the great thing about Botox is it's kind of no harm, no foul. If you don't like it, in 3 months, it's out of your system anyway. So the actual Botox is gone. You know, the benefits of the therapy and retraining you've done while you've been on it hopefully will remain. But so I don't think it's a very high risk thing, which is also really important for facial palsy patients, because you're already sustaining such a significant blow to your emotional status from dealing with this, that we don't want to do anything that's going to then create, oh my gosh, another thing. Like, you know, it needs to happen in baby steps so that we can build a rapport and get you better without taking, you know, big leaps that might leave you, you know, wishing you hadn't done something.
Right. While you're speaking, something very, I think, valid popped into my brain. And as much as I don't want to get into a full-blown discussion on the topic, insurance. How is it? Because Botox is generally considered cosmetic, and there can be a lot of trouble with insurance companies wanting to pay for and getting approved for those sort of things. What type of things can you suggest to people that they can bring to insurance companies so that they might be more likely to view it as a, you know, not a cosmetic action?
Yeah. So I have to give a huge shout out to my staff who just do a tremendous job working with people's insurance companies on this. I think it's 99 out of 100 people who have insurance that we get insurance coverage for the treatment.
Wow.
I just don't get denied on this, you know, thus far. And so I'll give a shout out to Jamie and Greta and Allison who just go through it's a lot of work. It really is. They do not want it to happen easily. So I think you know, if you have a provider like me who's doing it all the time, that obviously helps because we have a system for getting it authorized. But you know, this is a medical diagnosis. You have facial paralysis. And if you're getting Botox, you probably have hemifacial spasm or you have resting tone in the face that shouldn't be there. And that's a covered benefit by most people who have any insurance with prescription benefits. So, it's actually easier to get covered than honestly some of the other things that I deal with that maybe would seem less cosmetic. And it is not cosmetic. I mean, you know this firsthand, but as soon as you take care of, you know, 3 facial palsy patients, you get it into your head pretty quickly. Like, this is not a vanity thing. This is a huge quality of life thing. And these people have been, you know, reduced from their prior selves to this new normal. And, you know, how we could not do everything possible to try to get them back as high as, you know, high as they could on the ladder, I think. And luckily, because of that, I don't get a lot of pushback from insurance.
Well, that's wonderful news. Can you come out here? Because I know a few. This will probably be – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say it really is – I mean, Michael is a wonderful physician, but his staff, you know, knows the way to code it and the documentation that's needed. And I think – it's his staff that does that extra step that maybe some other physician groups don't have the staff to do it, or so forth, because it is very doable. It's just, it does take time. And you know, like with dealing with insurance, any condition, it's knowing the ways to get around certain things, and you know, not doing anything illegal. I don't want to say that, but it's just knowing, you know, that coding is a huge thing, and using the key codes to show that it's a medical condition and not a cosmetic condition goes a long way.
Gotcha. Yep. So I guess we'll wrap up in just a second. We've gone a little longer than I expected, but it's been fantastic. A lot of great knowledge. So if people would like to have more information, again, we can check out facialrecovery.com, or you can check out foundationforfacialrecovery.org. You have neuromuscular training, retraining, re-education videos. You have a bunch of other videos up on YouTube. So you can search Center for Facial Recovery. The Fix My Face is available on Amazon and also through your website and your foundation. I guess in closing, just kind of stepping away from the clinical side of it, what advice do you have or what can you say to people who are newly diagnosed or dealing with facial palsy? What can you kind of just kind of as a human and how they can kind of treat themselves and that sort of, because you see that, you've all seen the emotional side of this, and you know how this can really impact somebody's life. So what can you maybe say to people who are dealing with this right now?
So I'll start. The ladies are the experts. I mean, they have supported so many patients through so many sessions, through so many years, that I'll let them say, but I'll just say from my perspective that patients definitely need to grieve this process. It's a serious event that's occurred that has life-changing consequences, and you know, and everyone's going to adjust to that in their own way, and you know, the steps of grieving are what they are, and acceptance will hopefully come. But then, you know, redirecting is also a huge part of the grieving process, and putting that energy into the positive elements, the progress, the change that you see, you know, what your goals are, and then having the team partnership with your therapist and with me to say, or your doctor saying, you know, here's where I want to get, you know, like, let's try to get there, and checking each other on that. So definitely a lot of inspiration is the other main word I would use to describe what I've seen in my facial palsy patients. You know, the people who have overcome this emotionally and come out stronger on the other side, it's pretty, you know, awe-inspiring. And that a lot of people have gone through this before you. And that's not something that, you know, I take lightly saying, because I don't mean to diminish what people are experiencing, but just that there is kind of some comfort in knowing that, okay, there is a path here and I'm on it. I don't want to be on it, but I have this support structure trying to, you know, encourage me along the path. And so I guess that's like, those are kind of my general take on the emotional element of this, because it is really deep and profound. And then I'll let Jency and Jody kind of chime in with their part.
I think knowledge is power. I think once you understand what's going on and you talk to someone who has the knowledge to impart to you, then you can start to compartmentalize these things and realize that there is a path to recovery. But just having the right knowledge, do your homework, seek people who are well-versed in the subject. Not just, I mean, as you said, Brian, there are people who are very smart on Facebook and there are people that aren't so smart. So you have to weed through that and do your research.
And I would say, remember what the cause of this is. It's a virus. It's a virus that has attacked your body. So you need to take care of yourself. You need to, you know, get plenty of rest. You need to eat healthy. I'm not going to say you need to take supplements, but you need to eat healthy. As soon as you feel comfortable, get back to your exercise regimen. But really, it's important to remember that you've been sick and you will get better, but you need to take care of yourself. And you know, I know a lot of times patients with facial palsy tend to maybe put themselves on a back burner. And, you know, there's a statement that, you know, you're supposed to put your oxygen mask on first, they say on the airplane. You know, when you have facial palsy, put your oxygen mask on first. You know, look into like Jinsy and Michael were saying, the right regimens, but take care of yourself. And also, I guess the other important thing is this was not your fault. You didn't do anything to cause this. We get that question all the time. What did I do wrong? Why did this happen to me? What could I have done different? You didn't do anything. It just happened. Unfortunately, it just happened. It's not your fault.
Yeah, and then I'll throw on my normal, which is just be kind to yourself. You know, that's the biggest thing. You know, rest, do what you need to do to rest and recover, and just be kind to yourself. But yeah, thank you guys so much for being here. I think this has been a wonderful conversation about a topic that really isn't out there quite a bit. So I was really glad and happy to have you here and kind of discuss it a little bit more. And hopefully we can bring some more education to people and to other clinics and as well. And we can raise awareness and we can work towards that goal of having that initial set of onset be, you know, get the proper care that's needed, that we can, you know, reduce the number of people that have this residual effect. So, but I want to thank you guys so much. And once again, we have Jinsy Stezer from co-founder of the Center for Facial Recovery. We have Jody Barth, who is also the other co-founder, and we have Dr. Mike Riley also as well. Thank you guys so much for taking the time today. And is there a way that people can reach you through just through the foundation, through the website? Is that the best way?
Yeah, through that facialrecovery.com. Right. That there's a way to email us, and then we can our administrator will make sure it goes to the right one of us. And and I just want to say thank you, Brian, so much for this opportunity to spend this time with you and talk about something we're very passionate about.
Well, happy to do so. Thank you guys again. And thank you for watching and listening. And we'll see you next time.